Thank you. The London premiere of Chute d'Étoiles by Matthias Pincher. The BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Matthias Pincher with our two trumpet soloists. The Norwegian trumpeter Tina Ting Helset, making her Proms solo debut tonight. Although you may also have heard her a few weeks ago in a Monday Proms chamber music concert with her ensemble Ten Ting. As it happens, today is also her birthday, and she was serenaded by the orchestra with the traditional rendition of Happy Birthday to You at the start of this morning's rehearsal. You might have seen her on our Proms Extra programme on BBC Two yesterday, but if you didn't catch that, you can see what she had to say by watching again on the BBC iPlayer. She was one of Katie Derren's guests yesterday evening. And her fellow soloist tonight, Marco Blau, is a great favourite with contemporary composers. And he's particularly associated with Karlheinz Stockhausen. He's given many premier performances in the great operatic cycle Licht. Both soloists back on stage now. Marco Blau also now teaches and holds a post teaching contemporary art performance and trumpet studies at the Lucerne University College of Music. And just to bring things full circle, Chute d'Étoiles had its world premiere at the Lucerne Festival in August last year. And here are Marco Blau and Tina Ting Helset back on stage with Matthias Pincher. And he's applauding them warmly. He's always fascinated, he says, to hear performances of his music conducted by other people. But he did say that the Royal Albert Hall is, he feels, the perfect venue to hear this piece. With its huge contrast in dynamics between immensely loud and energetic and incredibly quiet. There's little fragments of sound being passed around the orchestra, as he put it, being reflected almost through the valves of the trumpets, interpreting that lead sound which he finds so fascinating. Well, both soloists and Matthias Pintscher make their way off stage, and they're going to be making ready in part two for another glittering orchestral showpiece with French connections, Stravinsky's complete ballet score, The Firebird. Now, this was the subject of today's Proms Plus intro, which took place at the Royal College of Music just across the road earlier this evening. And introducing that conversation now as our prom interval is Louise Fryer.
Hello, I'm joined by Jonathan Cross, Professor of Musicology at Oxford University, who specialises in early 20th century and contemporary music, and who's published two major books about Stravinsky, and who's currently working on a new biography of Stravinsky, and by composer Matthias Pintscher, who's the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra's artist in association, and who's conducting tonight's prom. Jonathan, how did Stravinsky come to write The Firebird?
I suppose the story goes back all the way to St. Petersburg. The piece really grew from those beginnings. This was Stravinsky's native city, but also there in the late 19th, early 20th century was the most extraordinary group of artists and intellectuals who found themselves gathering around one super extraordinary figure by the name of Sergei Diaghilev. He was first of all, a failed composer, one might say. He started off as a composer, showed his compositions to Rimsky-Korsakov, who rubbished them, and so he decided to reinvent himself as an art collector, an art historian, and he became this grand supremo. He set up a journal called Mir Iskustva, The World of Art, and what this set out to do was to try and reinvent Russian art, turning away from old Russian nationalism, inventing a new kind of nationalism, neo-nationalism, looking to the future. And eventually, to cut a very long story short, ballet became a part of this. Not the old ballet that they'd inherited from Tchaikovsky, but thinking of what ballet could do to conform to the aesthetic ideals of this World of Art group, which stood for a kind of anti-realism, so ritual, decoration, and Wagner was at the heart of this. Some of these figures, Diaghilev, a man called Alexander Benois, they were obsessed with Wagner and Wagner's idea of what Wagner called the Gesamtkunstwerk, the total work of art. And in their reinvention of ballet, they saw the coming together of music, of dance, of drama to project a new kind of Russian art. Stravinsky comes in rather late in this story because Diaghilev had taken a lot of these artworks to Paris. Paris discovered a real appetite for the Russian exotic, so Diaghilev gave them what they wanted. By 1910, this was the first time they presented something brand new, and The Firebird was this new work. But as I say, Stravinsky came in quite late. He was maybe the fourth or the fifth composer they tried who eventually said, yes, I'll write the music for this story.
And what gave him the chutzpah to do that, if you like? Because he was pretty much an unknown at that stage.
He was, yeah. Diaghilev had probably heard very little of Stravinsky's music, maybe an early orchestral showpiece. He commissioned Stravinsky to write two orchestral arrangements of some Chopin piano pieces, which formed part of the 1909 Russian season in Paris. And he saw something in that, he heard something in that, that thought, okay, we'll give this young 27-year-old a go and we'll see what happened. You know, he'd been turned down or let down by a number of very prominent Russian composers. I don't think anybody really imagined, though, that the extraordinary work would appear that did. And of course, this not only reinvigorated the Russian ballet in Paris, but it launched Stravinsky's career as well. Nothing was the same after that for him.
Let's have a listen just to the opening of the piece and see what remarkable music he created.
Thank you.
Matthias, you've been rehearsing this piece with the orchestra. Talk us through some of the effects that we were listening to there.
Well, what we just heard is one of the most remarkable spots that redefined the scope of orchestration, which is this one bar of, you heard these eerie harmonics going in various directions at the same time. It's nothing but a D7 chord, as ironic as it sounds, but it's just consists of those four notes. But what he does with it is incredible. He sets a bass and then has all the strings execute different kinds of glissandos in different speeds and different registers. And it's, in the end, nothing as a sustained D7 chord, but it has an inner life. And it's one of these perspective moments where we already see the foreshadowing, what Stravinsky eventually, or very shortly after, will do, especially with the Rite of Spring and Petrushka, where all the Rimsky-Korsakov is basically all stripped away, chipped away, and that's when the real Stravinsky, with his wit and his genius, is completely unleashed and unfolding.
Well, I think that's what Stravinsky was so good at, taking the ordinary and turning it into something extraordinary. As you say, it's just an ordinary chord, but it doesn't sound like it because of the way that it's orchestrated, the way those sounds are placed.
So where were his influences coming from?
From the Russian tradition. So he studied with Rimsky-Korsakov. So many of the ideas in this piece came from Rimsky. Rimsky was one of the great orchestrators, and that's where he learned a lot of these ideas, and also the harmonic ideas as well. But you can hear a number of other sources coming together in this piece, going back to Glazunov, even back as far as Glinka, bits of Scriabin, even maybe moments of Wagner in there as well. Those were the sources for Stravinsky.
And a little bit of folk music too?
There are some folk elements in there, yeah. There are two major folk tunes that appear. Now, Stravinsky wasn't a folk collector. He wasn't like Bartok going out into the field and with his gramophone and recording singers, you know, at work. He took them from secondary sources, and in both cases in this piece, they were actually taken from an anthology that was made by Rimsky-Korsakov, and he took the tunes directly. But again, this is something that earlier Russian composers would have done, taken these folk tunes and set them. Stravinsky does it rather differently. He always finds a new context for these very simple melodies, makes them something special.
And we have an example of that in the Round Dance. How does that fit into the plot? Because we haven't talked about that at all yet.
Well, this is music associated with the princess that the prince falls in love with. This is good fairy story stuff. You've got to have a prince falling in love with a princess. But we talked about the sounds we've just heard as being magical. Well, this is a very magical piece. And in a way, what we have is an opposition between the supernatural and the natural. The supernatural characters, whether they're evil characters like Kashtei the Immortal or good characters like the Firebird, have this magical music. The human characters have much simpler music. I would call it diatonic, which means essentially music that could be written on just the white notes on the piano keyboard. And this tune that we're about to hear is an example of that.
Thank you.
And what listeners won't have seen is Matthias's eyebrows going up at the moment that we hear that piccolo. It's an absolutely classic Stravinskian moment, isn't it?
One of the scariest moments of all soloistic woodwind playing in the pieces. And I've done this piece many, many times on different continents with different orchestras. And hardly at all you have eye contact with the player when this high note comes in. And it's interesting, they stare at you a couple of bars before, but when it's time, they just make sure that the note comes out. And it's one of those wonderful moments where you, in the role of a conductor, you can just love and share and make people feel as comfortable as you can and allow this high piccolo note to come in. And it's a very scary moment for all piccolos players everywhere. I mean, it's one of those moments where they really need you, though you can't do anything. It's just the gentle downbeat, and then it releases these beautiful textures.
It's a wonderful use of the orchestra, isn't it? Because he's got massive orchestral forces at his disposal, and yet picks his times for when he uses that.
Oh, absolutely. Some of the most striking moments in the entire score, in the whole ballet, is when you look at the page and there's very little information on the page. You have that with Debussy too, sometimes, that from looking at it from a composer's perspective, it's sometimes shocking how little information you do need on the page to obtain a maximum of sound. Just think about the opening, which we didn't hear right now, but like all this, it's like some sound has already been before there in this space, and then all of a sudden it just, you log in, and it's not really an opening. It's like a primordial condition of sound that has always been there for eternity, for centuries. And it just, we log in, our ear logs in, and there we are in this darkness, which already evokes our own images. And this is what makes this music so incredible. It's very personal. It's ballet music, but yeah, but it's very rhapsodic. It speaks without text, without singing, but it sings within the images and the colors. And there is only Tchaikovsky and Stravinsky who were able to compose with those evocative narrative images. And,
Jonathan, how much did Stravinsky know about ballet? Because he would never have seen the Ballet Russe.
No, but his father was a baritone, a very famous singer in his day with the Imperial Opera in St. Petersburg, in the Mariinsky Theatre. The family apartment was literally just over the road. So in a sense, he grew up in that theatre. He would have heard his father singing the great Russian roles, creating the great Russian roles, but also the standard operatic repertoire and the ballet. You know, he would have seen the great Tchaikovsky ballets and so on. So it was very much in his blood. And I think the point that Matthias was just making about the way in which the narrative, in a sense, is embedded into the music of this piece is crucial, because one might say that what we have here is an operatic score, even though it's a ballet. The story is told through music. In part, that's a result of the circumstances of its commissioning, in that Stravinsky came very late on. The scenario had already been written by Michael Fokine, who also choreographed the work, had even started mapping out some of the steps. So Stravinsky follows the story literally. You know, even if you don't see the ballet, you know what's going on. And you don't really get that when you just hear the concert suite. But tonight, when we hear the full version, there's a lot of what I might call orchestral recitative, where the drama is unfolding. Moments like the dance that we just heard are relatively rare, like an aria. But the story is constantly unfolding in the music in a magical way.
We have an example of that in the Magic Carillon. What's going on at this point?
This is the moment where the prince, Ivan, encounters the monsters who are, if you like, the retinue of the evil sorcerer, Kaschei. They try to cast their magic, their evil magic over him, because all young men that encounter these monsters are turned to stone. And so this is the magic music that for that moment symbolizes this. But this is another of these extraordinary Stravinskian moments that seems to point forward to the future, gives us a glimpse of the Stravinsky that is to come.
It's a wonderful layering effect, isn't it, that he achieves there?
As Jonathan just mentioned, this already foreshadows the writing of Stravinsky only like 2-3 years later. The addition of textual layers, which definitely comes out in The Rite of Spring, where we're introduced with very basic material, but then he adds more basic material, but it's like a grid that gets more and more complex and creates an incredible density. And totally new orchestral features like the Wagner tubas. There's 4 Wagner tubas which just played, which don't scream Wagner tuba at this moment, but it's a very interesting addition, like a new color you find on your, you develop on your palette, like Monet, in combination with the trombones. So it's like some sub layer of orchestration and sound, which was groundbreakingly new at this moment.
And like we were saying at the beginning, what's so interesting here is that each element in itself is relatively simple, whether it's a segment of a whole tone scale or something, but he layers one on top of the other, so the end result is extraordinarily complex, even though the individual parts are straightforward. And, of course, it fits perfectly with the narrative at this point. You know, those Wagner tubas are really rather nasty, and you can hear the sort of transformation of Castier's evil theme in the midst of it. You know what's going on, even if you can't see the dance.
Yeah, it's a very unpleasant environment at that moment.
And how does the prince get out of it?
Well, his get-out clause is the magic feather that he's taken from the Firebird. So he's about to be turned to stone, and he suddenly remembers he has the feather, so he waves the feather to summon the Firebird. So she arrives and casts her good magic over these evil monsters. So eventually, well, first of all, they dance their infernal dance, and then the whole edifice falls away, so that the princesses who are in the evil sorcerer's power are released, that the knights are turned back to humans from stone, the prince can get his princess, he marries her, there are lots of bells, as you would expect in Russian folk stories, and they all live happily ever after.
Let's just have a little bit of that infernal dance. Now, we're very familiar with that from the suite, and it was exotic then. Is it still exotic now? Is it a sound world that we're so familiar with we don't really listen to it anymore?
I don't know. I think that's an interesting question. I think we do come to it fresh each time we hear it. And although in many respects it's often said, you know, it's the greatest work that Rimsky-Korsakov never wrote, it looks back. But just in some of those moments we've been pointing out, you can hear hints of what's coming later. In that last excerpt, there's nothing in there probably that you wouldn't find in Rimsky or in Mussorgsky or even in Tchaikovsky, but it's what Stravinsky does with it that makes it fresh, that makes us sit up and listen to it every time we hear it.
Let me thank Matthias Pinscher and Jonathan Cross, and thank you too for coming.
Louise Fryer introduced tonight's Proms Plus intro, which was recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music. And you can listen again to that conversation, as you can to all our proms too, for 7 days after broadcast, by going to the Radio 3 website. From me, Penny Gore, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall. We're live on BBC Radio 3, the home of the proms, and online in HD sound. Now, the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra and Matthias Pintscher are moving on to the final work in their prom, Stravinsky's folk-inspired ballet The Firebird, played complete in the original 1910 scoring. I asked Matthias Pintscher how Stravinsky's music has inspired him as both composer and conductor.
I'm a great, great admirer of Stravinsky, and honestly, I think every single composer after Stravinsky has been consciously or unconsciously influenced by Stravinsky somehow, just simply by what he has created. So what I find especially intriguing about The Firebird and this version, we're playing the entire ballet, it shows a beautiful sense of storytelling. There's like two composers, Tchaikovsky and Stravinsky, who had that theatrical sense for writing genuine ballet music, who thought in images, they thought in movement, they thought about how to tell stories without singing involved. And The Firebird is, I think, the only score Stravinsky has ever written where the music is swaying so freely. It's the only piece. Already Petrushka and The Rite of Spring are completely different. Then he imposes his grid and allows a different kind of freedom inside the grid, but The Firebird still breathes the traditions of Rimsky-Korsakov, and it's the most French piece he has ever written. All the colors sound very inspired by his life in Paris at this time, and it's a score which I love very, very, very dearly, and it's so stunning in some of the moments when the orchestration is very simple and reduced. That's the moments where the soundscape and the scope of the sound feels maximized. For us composers, this is sometimes even shocking to see how much it needs in terms of what you put on paper to be able to generate a maximum of haptic and captivating sounds.
Tonight's conductor and artist in association with the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, Matthias Pintscher. Coming back on stage now to conduct Stravinsky's complete Firebird Ballet Score.